I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to an archive edition of Midday. Deindustrialization and the future of work. In just 4 years, in the late 1970s and early 1980s, General Motors and Bethlehem Steel eliminated more than 12,000 jobs, accelerating a manufacturing decline that had begun years earlier and setting in motion Baltimore's transition from an industrial to a tourist-based economy. But now, is Baltimore manufacturing making a comeback? What did our labor force used to look like? What does it need to look like? And where is work headed in the age of automation and globalization? Today, a rebroadcast of an event we recorded in October in front of a live audience at the Baltimore Museum of Industry. Our show is pre-recorded, so we can't take your calls and emails. Midday from the BMI starts right after the news.
And thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, we are delighted to join you from the Baltimore Museum of Industry on Key Highway here in downtown Baltimore. Our topic today, deindustrialization and the future of work. These days, when many people think of Baltimore, they point to Harbor East or Hamden or Federal Hill or Fells Point, perhaps, as the places where businesses are thriving and nightlife is vibrant. There was a time, however, when the happening neighborhoods were places like Curtis Bay and Sparrows Point, and the nightlife consisted of 24-hour shifts at General Motors and Bethlehem Steel. A little later, we'll talk to labor economist Dr. Julianne Malveau, Joe Jones, the founder of the Center for Urban Families, and Lauren Previance. She's with the Jane Addams Resource Corporation, which provides job training in one of our city's most challenged neighborhoods, Park Heights. But first, I'm pleased to welcome Anita Kassoff. She's the executive director of the BMI, and Philip Pack, who worked at the Bethlehem Steel Plant in Sparrows Point for more than 40 years. He was the plant's first African-American apprentice, plus Dr. Nicole King, a labor historian on the faculty of UMBC. So BMI, show them your love for our panel here on Midday. And we are not taking any phone calls today, but we do welcome your comments and questions via email. Our address is midday@wipr.org, and on Twitter, we're @MiddayTomHall. We're also streaming on Facebook Live on the WIPR Facebook page, thanks to our good friend, Jamila Kremple. So Anita Kassoff, thanks for having us down here to the BMI. I love this place. I've come
Thank
down
you.
Here many times and always enjoyed it. The story of industry in Baltimore is the history of our city. So tell us about the story that you're telling here and how you tell it in the exhibitions that you have at the BMI.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for being here. We're delighted to be recording from the Baltimore Museum of Industry today. We really are committed not just to telling the story of Baltimore's industrial past, but also to making sure that we are encouraging conversations about industry today and asking people to think about what the industries of the future might be, whether that's through our exhibitions or our public programs or our other activities. So how do we do this? One thing that we like to do is to make sure that we're responding quickly to current events. So for example, after the unrest following the death of Freddie Gray, we immediately installed a small pop-up exhibition that asked people to think about what it means for those neighborhoods that were hardest hit by the unrest when manufacturing jobs go away. Last year, we had a program series about deindustrialization, which looked at the impact of the loss of those kinds of jobs on Baltimore's workers and communities. And we're currently in the middle of a program series, of which this recording is one, about issues in industry. So this Thursday, for example, we are going to have a program here at the museum about the gig economy, which sounds like a very 21st century thing, but actually has deep historical precedents in the kind of piece work that workers did in Baltimore. So I would say, generally, what we try to do and how we tell this story is by encouraging conversation. In this instance, you know, sometimes questions that have to do with deindustrialization aren't always easy. There can be disagreement about what's caused the lack of these jobs and what the impact means for people, but we see ourselves as a community forum where these conversations can take place.
And Phil Pack, you are part of the living history of industry in this City and at Sparrows Point. You were the first African-American apprentice at Sparrows Point. Tell us what that means, what an apprentice did, and as you reflect now, having been retired for several years, what do you think the significance of that, of breaking that particular barrier is?
When I first went into the plant, there were 30,000 people employed there. Those jobs were jobs where you could raise a family, you could buy a home, you could send your kids to school. Now the jobs are all gone. Being the first black apprentice in the plant was very important because when the plant needed tradesmen and old employees were leaving, it was important to get new blood into the plant. So I came into the plant and I worked as an on worker. I was trained to read blueprints, do structural steel repairs, and do all the things necessary to keep that plant running. At one time, the Buffalo Steel Plant was the largest steel capacity plant in the entire world. We sent steel to China, to South America. We sent steel to places that didn't have steel manufacturing. Now, new technology, emerging economies all over the world, and finally, insurmountable legacy costs end up killing our plant and took that plant away. There's nothing there now. Everything is gone. All those jobs are gone. The ability to get a job now and to take care of a family of four, to buy housing, to do all the things that Americans love to do have been taken away because those were good union paying jobs. Now we have a society where the jobs are less as far as income is concerned. There are issues with health care, which I'm sure you're all aware of. The benefits that are now being paid by businesses now are far less than they used to be in those days.
Of the 30,000 employees at Bethlehem Steel, about what was the percentage of African Americans at that time?
I imagine it was about 30% of the employees at the Bethlehem Steel plant were African American. However, at the time, African Americans weren't allowed to go into higher paying jobs when I first went into the plant. They were denigrated to jobs that were very labor intensive, very dangerous, and hazardous to your health.
Did anybody see this coming when you were working there? I mean, the plant actually closed in 2012. When did you retire? What year?
I retired in 2008.
Mm-hmm. Was this the kind of thing that, because in the 1970s this started. I mean, it was a gradual deterioration of the steel industry, both here and in, Youngstown, Ohio, the other, big steel capitals. Did this take folks by surprise?
Actually, this started in about 1959. There was a 100-day steel strike. During that steel strike, businesses in this nation turned to foreign manufacturers. That allowed them to get their foot in the door. Once they got their foot in the door, it was hard for American manufacturers to get those customers back again.
And Nicole King, you're writing about this. You're also documenting stories of people like Phil Pack who worked at the plant, both men and women of that era. What are you hearing when they're telling you their stories?
Well, I think we look at statistics a lot of times. The 1970s to 2000, we lost about 100,000 manufacturing jobs in the Baltimore area. But numbers don't mean anything without stories and human beings behind them, because each of those jobs is, like Philip said, a story of a family, raising kids, sending kids to college, joining the middle class. And I think when we lose industry and we gain something else, because deindustrialization always has kind of, we could say, redevelopment, renaissance, the ideas of gentrification. In this city, very much you can see it on the ground in our harbor, at Harbor Place, when it changed from a working harbor to a tourist attraction. And those service industry jobs are not the type of jobs that Phillip's talking about here. And what I think, we can look at the long kind of boom and bust of deindustrialization in Baltimore and other cities like it throughout the US or throughout the globe, But what we really need to do is to talk to people on the ground to both understand the past and to develop work for the future that is equitable, that is just, and it allows a middle class in this country to continue to grow. So I think you learn most, and also I teach undergraduate students in the Department of American Studies, stories capture our imagination. Stories make things matter. And that's why me and my colleague, Michelle Stefano, who is in the audience, and other colleagues at UMBC have been working to collect these stories and to amplify these voices, in the words of Michelle, because they matter. They matter for the past, and they matter for the future of this city and other cities as well.
And Anita Kassoff, when it comes to retraining these workers, when it comes to understanding how to move forward, it is very important, and Phil Pack and I were talking about this before the show started, about how there's so many younger folks coming up trying to get into the manufacturing business as a career, and they don't know the history. And to move forward and to understand what the next step might be, understanding what has taken place is a crucial dimension of that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we want people to leave the museum being proud of our industrial past, but also realistic about what changing industry means and what it really means to be post-industrial. I mean, as Nicole said, the jobs have changed, but you could almost argue we're sort of different industrial, not post-industrial, if you define industry in a different way.
Mm-hmm. And Phil Packer, as you talk to the young folks that you have worked with in your capacity as a teacher and a speaker, I mean, are they figuring out ways of retraining themselves and redirecting their career aspirations? Is that a viable option? Do they see other things as viable options for themselves?
Everyone has that goal, but you have to remember the opportunities that were there in the past just aren't there now. Many young people have to work two jobs. Many young people have to team up with someone else to get an apartment or get a home. And the ability to do the things in the past that they used to could do just aren't there. So young people are looking for ways to do this. But just as an example, I mean, this nation needs many repairs in our infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, electrical grids. We need a lot of training and work to be done to repair what has been taken away in the past. But a lot of these answers are answers that we look to our government for, but so far they just aren't there.
Yeah, we'll just have to see what happens with infrastructure. It's been something that sort of hovered in the clouds for a while, and there's been so many other distractions so far in the first 10 months of this
administration.
Yeah. Nicole King, before we take a break, here's a email from Jeremiah, who asks, what facets of manufacturing are thriving in Baltimore, and how has it changed for better or for worse? Are there manufacturing industries that are doing well right now?
Well, we have, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, about 10,000 manufacturing jobs within the city. And I study the past. I don't really know exactly where those are. What I would think is that we have small firms. Lock Insulator just closed. We lost 84 jobs with that. That was located right...
That's near Port Covington.
Right.
So that's been bought up to be part of the development.
Right. And we could envision a future where jobs like, you know, Under Armour, manufacturing could come back, but there has never been, and this is from the wonderful history of Baltimore, political history from Matthew Crinson, that no declining smokestack city has successfully succeeded at reindustrialization. So we have to think differently about what manufacturing and what industry will look like. And in closing, we have to interact and engage and listen to our young people. I think that is of utmost importance. When we were on, had an event here, we had Destiny Watford and Charles Graham from For Your Voice and Curtis Bay, who are fighting, who won a fight against an incinerator. So I think we need to think about environmental issues, industry, and we need to always incorporate the voices of our youth in answering these questions.
Dr. Nicole King is a professor of American Studies at UMBC. Anita Kassoff is the executive director of the Baltimore Museum of Industry, and Philip J. Pack was a second-generation steel worker at Sparrows Point Beth Steel Plant and its first African-American apprentice. Coming up after a break, job training. What skills do the workers of today and tomorrow need, and how can they acquire them? We'll talk to the labor economist, Dr. Julianne Malveaux, Joe Jones of the Center for Urban Families, and Lauren Previance, who works at JARC, a job training nonprofit in Park Heights. You're listening to Midday Live from the BMI. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Thank you very much. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Midday, and today we are at the Baltimore Museum of Industry on Key Highway near the Inner Harbor in downtown Baltimore. We're talking about the history and the future of industry here in Baltimore. Joining us now, Dr. Julianne Malveaux. She's a labor economist and author, the former president of Bennett College for Women, and the president of Economic Education, a nonprofit organization in Washington, D.C. Joe Jones is here as well. He's the founder and CEO of the Center for Urban Families in Baltimore. He founded it in 1999. They provide programs and counseling to address issues of poverty, unemployment, father absence, and family disintegration. Lauren Previance joins us as well. She is the business service coordinator at the Jane Addams Resource Corporation. That's a job training organization in Park Heights. Welcome, it's good to have you. So we're not taking calls today, but we are taking emails and tweets, both from our listeners in Radio Land and those who are here with us at the BMI. Our email address is midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle is @MiddayTomHall. So Julianne Malveaux, we're at 4.2% unemployment, according to the figures from the Labor Department just last Friday. It's the lowest it's been since like 2001, something like that. In the African-American community, it's double that.
Yep.
In communities like the one in which Lauren Previance works, it's as high as 50%. So where do we go from here, given the political situation, given what happened in the election in November, given where we are at this moment, keeping in mind the historical events that have led to this moment for so many people, but where in your estimation is the place we should be looking in terms of our next step?
Well, a couple things. First of all, people celebrate this unemployment rate, but the unemployment rate hides a lot of stuff. You have people who have been dropping out of the labor market. So if you look at a statistic called the employment population ratio, what you'll find is that that number has been dropping, and especially been dropping for African-American men, for men in general, but more precipitously for African-American men. So you've got a number that's closer to 60% than the 70% that white men have. In addition, when you look at inner city employment, you will find the MPOP for African-American men hovering around 50% and even lower than that, which means that half of African-American men do not have work. Doesn't mean that African-American women are doing so well either, although we are working and our MPOPs are very similar to those of white women. We tend to be working in lower wage jobs. A third of all working African-American women earn less than $25,000 a year. So people will celebrate these unemployment rates. Now, you remember, they weren't accurate when a certain person was running for office. But now that a certain person, and I'm keep it clean because it's your show, now that a certain person has attained something, the numbers, there's two words I can't use in the same sentence. Y'all might guess what they are. But in any case, now these numbers suddenly have validity and there's something to be celebrated. What we have to do, when I was at Bennett College, I talked about entrepreneurship, global studies, and communications as key things that I wanted my students to graduate with. All of us, we see the labor market, we see the manufacturing sector, certainly. Manufacturing represents less than 9% of total employment, even though it still generates a sizable portion of our GDP. But technology has changed the way that manufacturing works. But one of the things we do know is that everybody will be, at some point in time, an entrepreneur, if not an intrapreneur. In other words, you've got to sell yourself and your corporations. Corporations keep cutting, and what's your job? To make sure that you're indispensable. But also, so many people, especially millennials, are looking at doing their own thing, starting their own business, whether it's a tiny business or a big business, and it's partially because they chafe against the rules, and that's a millennial thing, but partially also because they've seen their dads, their uncles, their aunts give it all to the corporation and then get laid off, you know, in a heartbeat, saying, you know, I don't want to go down that path. So one of the things that we must teach is entrepreneurship, and frankly, going with that is economic understanding. I mean, I meet people, they'll say to me, oh, you're an economist, I flunked that in college. Don't tell me that. Why would you tell me something silly like that? I really don't want to know that.
Not an important data point for you.
Not at all. I mean, so you're just basically walking up to me and saying, hi, I'm ignorant. But, you know, so I mean, we all need economic understanding. So people talk about tech, and certainly technology, STEM is important. But I tell people, if you don't want to do STEM, don't do STEM. Because for every engineer, there are two or three people who are supporting that engineer. So please do not think that because STEM, there's also STEAM, the arts are still important. But we do want to make sure that folks are at least computer literate. But we also are looking at other kinds of literacies. Thomas, you know, folks graduate from college and cannot write or write poorly because these things that we walk around with encourage you to say, you have a good day. You, not Y-O-U, people can't spell you. But in any case, we need literacy, we need economic literacy, numerical literacy. That's not higher math, it's just numerical literacy. How to count, how to, you know, what if the register goes down where you're working? But the, you know, there's a way for us to look like these great folks who do employment training, but we also have to look at the issue of planning, which is something in this country we chafe at. When you say planning, people think Soviet, as opposed to thinking, what are we looking at in the long term? What we know right now is one of the fastest growing areas, and it's going to grow even faster as my generation, the baby boomers, as we age. Of course, we said we would be forever young, and I believe we will be. But in any case, the healthcare industry is what's expanding, and we need to look at that. And again, that has something to do with science and things like that. But we need to look at the quality of our schools. Since a certain person has ascended into office, we have what the Department of Education is doing to inner city schools borders on the criminal. What they're doing in terms of higher education also borders on the criminal. They want to unregulate the new regulations that President Obama put in. Of course, if he did it, it was wrong, according to that person. But they want to unregulate for-profit universities. Now, for-profit universities are where black folks, brown folks, lower income folks, if they don't get into University of Maryland or Bennett College, they've seen these commercials that says DeVry, Corinthian, and they're going to spend money on that. And the Obama administration put in some regs regulating them, saying, y'all can't do that, and when you do it, there's some dots you have to cross, I's you have to dot, T's you have to cross, whatever. Betsy DeVoid, stands for devoid of good sense, she's actually put a rule out now that says they want to unregulate them. They can charge whatever interest they want. They can do whatever they want. And so we're really seeing education, even as we talk about needing a better educated workforce, we're seeing education being attacked. One of our tragedies, which shows us what our deficiencies are, is to look at who comes to this country with H-2B visa. And basically people from India.
That's a special worker visa.
People can come on a visa if they assume that we cannot find people in the United States to fill these jobs, therefore you must have people, immigrants, come in and fill a job. I have nothing.
And an employer has to prove that she can't find anybody in the United States to take that job, so she needs to hire somebody from.
Precisely. Right. Now, Silicon Valley is a stone's throw from San Jose, which is about 50% Latino. So as opposed to going to India to get somebody, there's a school up the street that you could put a training program in. You know, that has not occurred to these brilliant people mm-hmm. because it's basically cheaper for them and it's easier for them to exploit these workers. Again, I have sure. nothing against immigration. I think that immigrants bring a lot to our country, but I think that the way that the people are coming through the H-2B shows us what the deficiencies of our education system are.
And Joe Jones, let's talk a little bit about that training. One of the things that you've done and the Center for Urban Families has really become a national model for this kind of thing is advocacy. So you advise thought leaders, politicians, political business leaders. What do you tell them we need? When you're doing your advocacy, what are the What's the elevator speech to them in terms of what they need to do to move the ball forward?
Yeah, you know, for us, it's thinking about who it is that we serve, and from a geographical context, we're located in the greater Mondawmin community. And that encompasses three contiguous zip codes, 21215, which would be the Park Heights community, Greater Mondawmin, 21217, and a little bit of further west going towards Coppin State College, 21216. And when you think about the issues that the people who we serve face, that helps to drive what we think about in terms of advocacy. So one of the things that we know that within those three zip codes, as an example, there are approximately 4,000 considered non-custodial parents, the majority of whom are men, not exclusively because there are some women in that number, but 4,000 non-custodial parents in those three zip codes who owe an aggregate of $26 million in back state owed child support. It's also three of the top zip codes that people return from incarceration come to, and when we look at a financial assessment of the people who come in, not only are a lot of the men saddled with that debt that I mentioned, but Dr. Malvo had mentioned these proprietary schools that have really exploited our community. So we see people who've taken out loans, and those loans typically range between $8,000 and $15,000. And so when you look at the level of debt that a person comes into the door with, it really depresses their sense of optimism. It's almost as if I can't, regardless of what I do. And so we try to think about, from an advocacy standpoint, looking at those issues, how do we work with the state and the feds to reform child support so that, yes, it's important for a man or a woman, whoever the non-custodial parent is, to be financially responsible for their child, but we also don't want to push a person so deep underground that the likelihood that they could come above ground and play the mainstream game. And when I say play the mainstream game, we're talking about somebody who on average owes $10,000 to $15,000 in debt. So we help them to get a job, and we can do that in partnership with the stuff that we do with JARC and some of our other job training providing partners. And you get them into an entry-level job that pays somewhere, for our data, it's between $11 and $12 an hour, substantively above the minimum wage, but not a family sustaining wage at that point. However, if they owe that kind of debt that we're talking about, and if you just look at child support debt as an example, for every dollar that they owe, the state can take up to 65 cents of that dollar. So you're talking to somebody who's coming with a sense of, I'm not sure if this really is going to work for me, and you apply
and
logic and reason.
Garnishing wages.
Yeah. Right? And so they get their first check, because they may get that first check before the garnishment hits. Second, third check hits, it's been tagged, for that debt, that accumulated debt. And what it says to a person is that, you now need to think about what you're going to do in terms of an alternative, which is, in a lot of cases, go into the underground economy. The underground economy does not always mean something illegal, but it does mean that people are working under the table, therefore they're not contributing to the tax base, they're not taking care of their health the way in which we would like them to do. And in the long term, as taxpayers, we pay more for trying to care for that person down the road than if we reform some of these ill-fated practices from the beginning.
And Lauren provides, Joe mentions child support. You're dealing with these kinds of issues with the folks that you're training, and there are some other barriers that you have all the time. I mean, sometimes it's child care for custodial parents, transportation, basic stuff. They don't have a car in the bus system. We don't have a red line getting from east to west now. That's a whole other show, or 20 shows. But talk about the people that you're training, because sometimes you're placing folks in jobs that are paying $16 to $22 an hour. I mean, this is very much a living wage.
Right, Tom. At JARC, we are seeing an average of about 16 to 20 an hour. And again, we specialize in the trade of welding and also CNC, computer numerical control. And that training is free to the trainee as well as to the company, because we are a nonprofit. A lot of the barriers that we do see, yes, childcare, transportation, also folks re-entering from prison systems. Those who have employment type of backgrounds, like you have a hard time retaining your job. So at JARC, we focus on not only the technical skill, but a lot on the soft skill. And I believe, like Dr. Melville said, a lot on the education portion. We teach financial literacy with the technical skill.
Also, and you're also matching employers with employees. So manufacturing employees, because there is this notion that manufacturing is dead, it's gone, it's, you know, it's old school, it's not going to happen, not going to come back, get over it. But you're actually finding jobs for people in welding and as you say, CNC. And the employers are coming to you and saying, we need this. And you're saying, okay, I can deliver you a class of people who can do that.
Right. And to piggyback off of Joe, it's a dual customer approach. We're serving the community, but also to the manufacturing companies. So whatever that manufacturing company is lacking in is what JARC tries to customize the training around. So if there is a specific need, again, around literacy or blueprint reading or just having a person show up to work on time, which I hear is the biggest problem, we focus a lot on that, and there's heavy coaching involved.
And Julia Malvo, there are manufacturing jobs and manufacturing industries in which the workforce is aging. It's these baby boomers, right? And the people who own these businesses are telling me, and they're telling scholars who are writing about it, that it's difficult for them in many instances to replace those aging workers with younger people who will, as you know, Lauren is saying, be trained and show up on time and do the job.
You know, industrial education, vocational education, these are things that are missing from our high schools these days. As an educator, I do heavily emphasize going to college. But the truth of the matter is that everybody does not want to go to college, and everybody does not have to go to college. There are lots of manufacturing jobs, as you say, but also crafts jobs. I mean, live in an urban area and try to find a plumber or carpenter or, you know, I mean, you can find them, but it'd take a while, and they may be okay and they may not be. So there are opportunities out there that are outside of the college band, but there is very little information. Our high schools have cut back so much. I mean, cut back on things like band and sports, and people think, well, those are frivolous, but they're not necessarily. Sports keep you in good shape for the rest of your life. But they also cut back on vocational education. What are your options? And in addition, Tom, they've cut back on counselors. There's a school in Newark, New Jersey that has one counselor for 900 seniors. One counselor for 900 seniors. So if those young people are lucky, they might get one bite at the apple in the whole senior year. I had one, and when I was at Bennett College, I admitted a young lady, and I tried to run the school, but other people thought they were running it too, so that was always interesting. So admission said, you just admitted this girl, she has no recommendations. I said, well, let me get some. The counselor said, I don't know her, and this was the counselor who told me, I have 900 kids. So when we starve our schools, we're starving our young people, but we're also starving the labor force and the future of our GDP. So, you know, we're like the farmer who ate their seed corn as opposed to saving it until planting time. And we're cutting our high schools to our own detriment.
Dr. Julianne Malvo is an economist, an author, and commentator. She's the president emerita of Bennett College for Women and the host of the podcast It's Personal with Dr. J. Joe Jones is the founder and CEO of the Center for Urban Families. Lauren Previance has been with us in this segment. She's the business service coordinator at the Jane Addams Resource Center. That's a job training organization in Park Heights. And if you're interested in participating in the training program at JARC, the next orientation session will be held a week from tomorrow. That's the 18th of October from 9 to 1. You can send us an email, midday@wypr.org, and we'll give you the information you need. So Lauren Previance, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much for having me.
We will have more with Dr. Julianne Malvo and Mr. Joe Jones when we come back from a break. Before we take that break, a programming note about an event here at the Baltimore Museum of Industry. Anita Kassoff mentioned it earlier. On Thursday night at 7 o'clock, they're going to continue their series of programs called Issues in Industry. On Thursday, the topic is going to be, as Anita said, the gig economy. Joshua Clark Davis of the University of Baltimore will moderate a panel of entrepreneurs. They're going to talk about the issues and opportunities in the gig economy. If you come to our website, wypr.org/midday, we'll give you a link to the details. You're listening to Midday live from the BMI. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. And thank you very much. Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're broadcasting today from the Baltimore Museum of Industry. We're talking about deindustrialization and the future of work. My guests until the top of the hour are Dr. Julianne Malveaux, a labor economist and the president of Economic Education, that's a nonprofit organization in Washington, D.C., and Joe Jones. He's the founder and CEO of the Center for Urban Families here in Baltimore. As I mentioned earlier, we're not taking calls today, but we are taking questions submitted via email. That address, midday@wipr.org. You can also find us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. So, Joe Jones, what are you training folks to do when it comes to the job market? What's your take on what the manufacturing scene is, the industry scene is, the gig economy, as you look towards the future, what do these men and women need to know how to do?
Well, the Center for Urban Families, we have a comprehensive approach to looking at how we lift individuals and families up relative to their family stability and to their economic circumstances. Relative to their economic circumstances, we try to penetrate the community by having a team of folks that go out through Baltimore City and talk to people where they are and have them come into the center. And we focus exclusively at that point on essential or soft skills, helping a person, mainly because about 55% of the folks who we serve have had some brush with the criminal justice system, misdemeanor, felony, or a combination of the two. And so recognizing that this is a population of folks who, they've learned how to survive oftentimes in tough environments, and converting that ability to comport themselves in that environment to a workforce environment takes a little bit of cognitive shift. And so we really work on building that capacity to understand how you can comport yourself in that environment. But we also recognize that if they have that kind of experience at that rate, that means that in this country, we have sucked up large numbers of people, particularly African-American men, from communities into the criminal justice system. Right, and then we redeposit them in the community and we say, go for it. And go for it means that you are actually limited in terms of certain segments of the labor market that you can get into. So finance is pretty much out for you. Dr. Mulville earlier had mentioned, the emerging opportunities within the healthcare sector. Well, within healthcare, you may be able to get into entry-level positions, but non-clinical, non-technical, if you have a criminal background. And so we really have to think about in this new, ever-changing economy, what does it mean? So earlier it was mentioned, the work in terms of building out the Port Covington footprint. We are doing some piloting, with Sagamore Development, which allows us to use what's called the Foundry, which includes makerspace. So some of what JARC does, there's some of that happening at Sagamore. And so we get them exposure to skills training there and a pre-apprenticeship model. And then we can partner with an organization like JARC or the Job Opportunities Task Force Jumpstart Program to get people into apprenticeship training or into the kind of trainings that JARC has. But you see that, with advanced manufacturing, and while manufacturing isn't what it used to be, it is, as it continues to try to come back and whatever level it comes back to, it's going to require the use of technology, the proficiency in technology. And when I heard Mr. Pack, it broke my heart to hear Mr. Pack, as an African American man who was one of the first, who was the first apprentice to go into into that industry at his job. And you think about when that got disrupted, there was really no on-ramp to help that population of men transition into a new, technological and service economy. And so what actually I saw in our community talking about the storytelling is large number of men who then made their way into the illegal drug trade. Right? And that became a place where you used to be able to pay for school and education doing the right thing, you are now able to do it doing the wrong thing. And we have now found ourselves in a very precarious situation in this country where we have large numbers of people talking about Baltimore City who are X'd out of certain sectors of the economy. So we have to be very thoughtful around what I would call forensics labor market analysis to be able to see within a labor labor sector. Where within that labor sector can you get a job if you happen to come from a challenged background? Or how do we help you to think about entrepreneurship? And I will say that, you know, it's really easy to say entrepreneurship, but to actually sit down with somebody and walk them through that process where they can build the competency and the ability to stay in business. Because it's not just about trying to do something and start it, it's about staying in. How do we build that infrastructure within our communities so that rich talent, intelligence that we have in our community, people can take advantage of and learn the skills to be entrepreneurship, where they then in turn can hire other people.
And Julian Malveau, we hear a narrative that says that so many of the jobs that are created by small business people. So we're not going to be looking to the large manufacturers. I mean, the Beth Steels and the IBMs of the world aren't going to be hiring, you know, massive numbers of people, although we're hearing here in Baltimore that we're competing for a headquarters of Amazon along with
a bunch
of other places that will bring 50,000 high-paying jobs to town. We'll see what happens with that. But with this small business focus, it's interesting that, frankly, guys who are slinging dope on the corners are actually small business people. I mean, if Joe is
no, they're entrepreneurs.
Successful in, you know, helping them translate those skills to a small business environment, they can be very valuable to employers.
Oh, absolutely. They're entrepreneurs now. I mean, they're figuring out how to fill a need, although the need we wish we didn't have, but how to fill a need, how to market a product, how to tell you that the product is unique enough. And so they are, you know, entrepreneurs. So what has to happen is that there have to be structures to translate their skills into the above ground, if you will, economy. Which, and in some cities, I was just in Atlanta in a building that's an incubator for small businesses. And so an incubator is a place where basically a city or someone is subsidizing the startup costs. So you have people who are starting a business, but they've got the rent covered. They've got some of their structural costs, their phones, some of the other things covered, and they've got advisors. And so they can, and everybody doesn't make it. I mean, the tragedy of entrepreneurship is that probably 80% of small businesses go out of business within 5 years. And usually it's because they're undercapitalized, they don't have the money, because they have poor advice, or because they didn't think far enough ahead. Unfortunately for many African-American small businesses, many people start their business, they're self-financed, as opposed to getting a bank loan because, again, of discrimination in banking and things like that. So you really got, there's a set of barriers, but the barriers can be overcome if there is a structural and government buy-in. Now people say, oh, government, we don't want big government, but it's not about big government. I mean, what would you rather pay, incarceration costs or business incubator costs? I mean, it's a real simple kind of trade-off. And, you know, Joe, when you were talking about the folks who have been formerly incarcerated have barriers, one of the things that we don't look at are the laws that prevent people who have, especially felonies, from entering certain occupations. Yep. Now, I could see that if you were convicted.
Yeah, you mentioned clinical jobs and that kind of stuff, and we have so many people saying that, you know, Alec Ross, a young guy who happens to be running for governor right now, wrote a book called The Industries of the Future, and he said what computer code was to the 90s, genetic code is going to be
precisely
moving forward.
But, you know, in Illinois, there are 150 occupations that you cannot fill if you have a felony.
150.
One of them is barber. Now, again, if you were convicted of murder, I'm not sure I want you with a razor near my throat. But other than that, why can you not be a barber with a felony? So basically, we have discriminated against people as opposed to say, let's bring them back into the fold. As you said, you have these folks, they go to jail, they do their time, you know, serve their time, they pay society back, and then we just sit them out there. You know, some jurisdictions have the block the box, so you don't have to push the box and say that you have been convicted. But let's be real. At some point it comes up and there is discrimination. But also, other than that, some of the things that people learn in incarceration, like barbering, they cannot then come out and go work at a barbershop because they have a felony. So, there, you know, it's a combination of things. And I would have to say, if we go back to the question that you've raised and is raised at this wonderful museum about deindustrialization, one of the things we have to think about is what role race has played in this. I mean, because we really don't talk explicitly about it, but a couple of things that happened is when some of these labor forces began to integrate, you began to see tensions of people thinking about ways to get out. If you look at Detroit, when Coleman Young became the mayor of Detroit, the auto industry started saying, it's time for us to leave Detroit. Why? Because you had a black mayor? What are you saying? And then, you know, of course, in 1968, when we had the uprisings following Dr. King's assassination, you had a lot of people begin to look askance at cities. And then you have, of course, what I call the anti-urban bias of state legislators, because these state legislatures mostly come from rural areas. And so when you say, let's put some help into Baltimore, into the inner city, you know, Baltimore, you know, any place, Detroit, these legislatures say, no, that's all right. You know, let them sink or swim. Forgetting that this is part of the tax base. These are the people, I mean, crime is not, if you think that these people are going to be criminals, they could get on a subway and come get you too. Just for the record. So it's not like you can restrict it to an area. So the role that race plays is one that's often ignored, and yet what we see is these majority-minority cities with African-American, usually mayors, and with an antipathy towards African-American people, preventing the kind of participation that we like to see in terms of preserving jobs, growing new jobs. We're not going to go back to the manufacturing of old, no matter what. It's just inefficient right now. I'm going to be Hillary and say, you know, the coal jobs are going away. And somebody said, oh, no, I'll bring them back. No, you can't bring them back. I mean, you cannot unring the bell. But there will be different kinds of manufacturing.
And a lot of it, Joe, is relationships, is it not? I mean, you're building relationships, as are the people at the Jane Addams Resource Corporation, with manufacturers or with employers. Mm-hmm. And they are, because there is a certain leap of faith that they may need to take if they're going to hire a returning citizen or if they're going to hire somebody who has very little work experience. But if you have those personal relationships, things can happen.
Yeah, I say if there are people in the listening audience who are interested, men and women age 18 and above, who are interested in our next Strive job training program, they can come. The next class starts this Friday at 10 a.m., and they can call our office at 410-367-5691, and folks can share with them. The process is very easy. There are little restrictions to people coming in. But I'll tell the story of this guy, David Anderson. So David Anderson was an ex-offender. He came to us, and he had a certain appearance that would threaten you, right? That's just who he is, a big guy, and he looked ornery all the time, right? And we allowed him to come in. We absorbed his orneriness, if that's a word, and we allowed him to be who he was, but we also challenged him to think through, how do you convert what you learned on the street to a new way to participate in the labor economy? So he takes us up on it, gets an entry-level job. He starts working for an exterminator. He learns the craft. He then creates his own business. He comes back to us. We support him through that journey. He then wants to become a homeowner. We supported him in that process. So now he's an entrepreneur, yeah, hiring employee, and owns a house in Baltimore City. Yeah. That is what we can replicate if we have the will to be able to support the people in our
just
city.
Just got to scale
right
that
thing
up. Absolutely. Well, I'm sorry that that's all the time we have. I very much appreciate both of you guys coming by. Dr. Julianne Malveau, her podcast is called It's Personal with Dr. J. She's the president of economic education in Washington, and Joe Jones, the founder and CEO of the Center for Urban Families here in Baltimore. So that'll do it for this edition of Midday Live from the BMI. We want to thank everybody who has joined us today in our audience, and thanks to those of you listening on the radio or online. We're grateful to Anita Kassoff, Ani Gellis, and the staff at the BMI for their invitation and their hospitality. There's a lot to see and experience here at the BMI. Come to our website, wipr.org/midday, and we'll have a link for details on all of the events and exhibitions. We want to thank Luke Spicknall, Matt Taka, and Ray Heppner for their invaluable help in making this live broadcast possible. Thanks also to Joe Squared for providing lunch back at WIPR. Joe Squared serves cold-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. Coming up tomorrow, we'll be back in Studio A for a conversation about whether or not Donald Trump is mentally fit to serve as president. The founder of a group of mental health professionals called Duty to Warn makes the case that the president should be removed from office under the 25th Amendment, which calls for removal if the president is impaired. More than 62,000 psychiatrists and psychologists have signed a petition advocating for Mr. Trump's removal. But of course, more than 62 million people voted for Mr. Trump. And many in the mental health field think that the so-called Goldwater Rule should remain in place. That's the directive that prohibits mental health providers from offering a diagnosis of someone that they've not personally examined. So we'll take all that up tomorrow with Dr. John Gartner, the founder of Duty to Warn, and Dr. Alan Dyer. He's a psychiatrist from George Washington University. Until then, from the Baltimore Museum of Industry, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Tom.